Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Emerge. This week on the show, we have a special treat. Rob Berbea is back on the show, and he and I are actually going to respond to some of the questions that arose as a result of sharing our previous conversation about Rob's work with the Imaginal and the soul-making Dharma. So we'll set context in the show, but I'm really happy that we got to have this sort of conversation that emerged in response to the inquiry that the previous show catalyzed. That's really exciting to me, and I'm hoping that as more listeners tune into the show and we dabble in more domains, that will be a thing that we do here at Emerge, that we respond, you know, that we don't just put things out and let them be final, but instead acknowledge that anything like this is just part of an ongoing conversation and inquiry. And so very, very happy to share this episode with you. So please enjoy this episode of Emerge. Welcome to another episode of Emerge. On this episode, we have back again on the show, Rob Berbea. And in this conversation, we're going to respond to questions, concerns, and feedback that arose in response to our first conversation that we shared. Particularly some feedback that we got from the subreddit Stream Entry. And so just to set context for this conversation, I want to appreciate a couple Redditors, Duff Stoic, Philosophy Guru, Armila Nymphs, and Aspirant 4, among others, for contributing to what I thought was a really vibrant and useful conversation about the previous podcast episode we recorded together. And, you know, there were some comments that I thought verged on trolling, but actually a lot of it was really beautiful and well-conceived. And I think for me, I saw it as an expression of interest and curiosity. And so I just want to like honor that. I thought that was really cool, and that also name that this conversation and the questions that we're going to be focusing on are basically pulled directly from that thread. I did a little bit of reinterpreting and reassembling, but the questions themselves are pretty much verbatim, more or less, from that thread. And so, you know, the basic and general feedback, I think if I could synthesize it in one sentence, would be that a lot of folks left that previous conversation not really feeling like they understood what soul making actually is, or what the imaginal actually is. And some people actually expressed a lot of kind of suspicion or concern about that. And so hopefully by directly addressing some of the questions that were brought up in that thread, we can give you a better sense and enough kind of context to help you feel comfortable maybe diving into the actual recordings on Dharma Seed, if that's something that ends up being interesting to you. And so we're not going to try to do the job of the audio recordings that are available on Dharma Seed, but our goal is instead to respond to the confusions and questions that were surfaced through our last conversation. So all that being said, in terms of context, Rob, welcome back to Emerge.
Thank you, Daniel. I'm really happy to be here again with you.
Great. Yeah. And so to do this well, I have decided to do my best to kind of, let's say, channel. Rob, I think I can hear you typing.
Yeah.
Oh, I've, okay. I see.
We're going to pause. We're gonna you're like
pretend
echoing a little bit. I'm not sure. Should I close some tabs? Would that help on my computer? Some internet tabs?
Yeah, that wouldn't hurt. Sure.
So let me close. As usual, I have too many things open. So, okay.
And so it's sounding like I'm echoing and cutting in and out for you.
There were just places it kind of like, it sounds like it trembles and yeah, exactly. Cuts in and out, but just at times, maybe that's better now. I've closed a lot of tabs and, I'll also close the email. I mean the, yeah, let's see. Okay. Let's try that. That's probably as good as it's going to get. So it's good.
Okay, so let's just pause for a couple moments and then I'll resume. Okay, so in terms of this, the questions I'm going to be asking, I decided that it would be interesting and useful to sort of channel where I imagine the questions are coming from. And I think I can do that because I was kind of a member of the pragmatic Dharma scene for many years. And so, you know, in service of that, I'm going to represent some of these questions that were asked in the thread to Rob. And Rob has agreed to kind of be a good sport about that and let me do that. And so, Rob, do you have any kind of additional context you'd like to lay out before we jump into the actual questions?
No. What kind of thing did you have in mind?
Nothing in particular. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to speak on the topic of context.
Only that, like I said, I haven't seen as much of the responses as you have, and nor do I know that community and what their particular kind of concerns or set of assumptions are and skills, if we say, are. So I don't know that community. I haven't seen the questions, just a little bit that you sent me in the email, but I'm certainly happy to try and do that. And then perhaps there are some larger kind of perspectives on just the whole intention and process and challenge of talking about all this stuff. We can get to that later, I suppose.
Great. Wonderful. Okay. So then let's jump in with what I think was my favorite question, you know, as long as it was seen, at least from my held lightly, you know, not to reify this question too much, but, you know, so here's the concern. Often, when something cannot be explained in plain English, it ends up just being bullshit. And the Redditor in question linked to a picture about how to understand science articles, right? So average sentence is hard to understand and subject matter is simple. It's probably just bullshit. So in a sentence or two, again, this is a question from the Redditor, in a sentence or two, explain the imaginal in plain English. What is it? What are the practices specifically, and how are they better and or different than traditionally Buddhist ones?
Okay, so that's three questions that you want me to answer in a couple of sentences. But so let's can we break them down into at least three questions? Is that okay?
Yeah, I mean, we'll process this together as best we can. So maybe we can start with in a sentence or two. Can you explain the imaginal in plain English?
Okay, so I'll try. Then, as I said, later we can talk about perhaps the kind of assumptions behind the question, etc., and why it might be not so simple to explain it simply. But let's say when we talk about the imaginal, when we talk about the imaginal in this what we're calling soul making dharma, we're really talking about, if you like, kinds of perceptions. Okay. Now, usually when we talk about imagination, we mean just something that's available to my private eye, but we mean both so-called inner intrapsychic and outer, if we like, extra psychic perceptions. So perceptions of the world, perceptions of imaginal figures that appear just to me, we mean all that, but also certain kinds or ranges of perceptions of the world of things that everyone would agree is there. This tree in front of me, this person that we can all see is there, the fields, the bird song we can hear, whatever it is, as well as more private perceptions. And when we say imaginal, we're not really talking about a kind of firm, sharp division. I prefer to talk more about a spectrum. So we can talk about perceptions that are more fully imaginal or really less fully imaginal. So first thing is we're talking about perceptions. And those perceptions, whether they're inner or outer, so-called, are, if you like, held in and supported by, opened up by certain ideas that don't hold a view that this perception is real, nor mm-hmm. that it is unreal. So when we talk about the imaginal, we're also talking about not just perceptions, but also conceptions. Now, usually when we perceive, whether it's an inner experience or an outer experience, we tend to think it's real or it's not real. And this opens up that whole dualism, the dichotomy, to allow conceptions of what we are perceiving and who we are and what is happening and where we are going that are not restricted by our usual kind of more limited conceptions. So the imaginal involves perceptions, inner and outer, okay. that are that are not restricted by the conception. Now, what kinds of perception? They are perceptions that touch the beholder deeply. They are perceptions that strike the person with as beautiful, deeply beautiful, movingly beautiful. But not just we're not just talking about the kinds of universal mystical perceptions that people might be familiar with, perceptions of oneness, perceptions of universal love, being, awareness, and this kind of thing. We're talking about perceptions, or mostly we're talking about perceptions that involve and enhance and have important to them the particularities of things, not a dissolving of particularity, but a bringing out and a celebration and an honoring and a reverencing of particularities. And what we perceive also starts to have a kind of personhood. So all these characteristics mm-hmm. are part of the kinds of perceptions we're talking about. Particularity, personhood, beauty, eros, yes. humility.
So Rob, I'm channeling this Redditor, at least my archetype of a Redditor. And, you know, he said in a sentence or two, and you went real, you know, you said a lot, and it makes sense to me, Daniel, but I can imagine somebody listening and feeling like, well, that was just a lot. That wasn't one or two sentences. I can explain meditation, you know, Buddhist meditation. You sit down until you're enlightened. That's two sentences, you know, and I want to, again, represent that desire for kind of simplicity. Is there a kind of nugget that you would point to as being what the imaginal is?
I mean, if I say the imaginal is a kind of a whole possibility of the art of perceptions that bring, that open up soul making.
Mm.
That's it. So the practice of the imaginal, sensing the soul, is the art of perception that opens up soul making.
Beautiful. And the second question this Redditor asked was, what are the practices specifically? You know, again, here I'm imagining he's like, oh, well, I know in meditation, I follow the breath at my nose, and that is what I do when I meditate, you know? And so, what are the practices in the same way that following the breath is for Buddhist meditation, perhaps? What are the practices of the imaginal that are clear and succinct and that you can kind of see?
I don't think I can limit them. Part of what the, if you like, the conception of the imaginal is that it's not limited. So there will be an infinite amount of practices. If I had to sum up what they do, is that, again, they're practices of perceiving either things in the world that everyone would agree that are there, this desk, my body, this person, or inner, so-called inner things, characters that might appear to me, perceiving them, meditating on that perception, holding them in perception in ways that open up soul making. But what I actually work with in that, it could be anything at all. It could be, as I said, it could be my body, it could be my illness, it could be my death, it could be this person there, it could be some figure, it could be a tree, it could be anything at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, so maybe I can reformulate this question and say, like, what is a particular example of a practice somebody might do if they were practicing in the imaginal work?
Okay. So, if I can divide it into this kind of artificial division, just for now, for ease of explanation, between so-called inner appearances, if you like, something that arises in my private imagination on one hand, and then extra psychic, looking at an object that everyone would agree was there. In the first case, a person might be meditating or and even gets distracted, and some figure arises in the imagination or some scene, or they might have been touched by a dream the night before in which there was a figure or a scene. And then they take that image and can work with it in ways that include, I'd say quite a fair amount of sophistication meditatively in terms of the sensitivity of heart, that's involved, the sensitivity to what we call the energy body, the certain ways of feeling one's somatic experience and conceiving of the body, and also sensitivity to conception, bringing all that subtly and delicately into a kind of relationship with this internal imaginal figure or scene, in a way that supports soul making, which also is a word I haven't explained yet. But the same could apply to this apple tree. I'm got my eyes open. I'm looking at it, and I'm bringing all that what I just talked about, my whole sensitivity of the energy body, of my heart awareness, and all the subtlety there, and my conception into relationship with what I behold with my eyes, that everyone else would agree was there, and I'm perceiving it and conceiving it in ways that open up the experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And So I think, listeners, you might get a sense of how difficult it is to really nail down a practice like we might be able to with Buddhist meditation in the example I use. So I think there are also some really good examples in the thread that you can find of people expressing what imaginal practice is like for them or how they experience it. But moving on, I think there's another thread of questioning that I found to be really interesting around the fitting in imaginal practices with kind of more traditional Buddhist orientations to the path. So specifically, the questioner wanted to know, like, where do imaginal practices fit into the three trainings of Buddhism? The three trainings, for listeners who aren't aware, are, I believe, morality, concentration, and insight, I think is how they're typically, or how I've heard them translated. Maybe, Rob, you have a different sense of them, but how do the imaginal practices fit into those three trainings from your perspective?
So the first one, ethics, it's in Pali is sila, is forms a basis. It really forms an important basis, a sort of commitment to understanding of an inquiry into ethics forms a basis for all the practices that we do. Someone coming to these kinds of practices without that basis and a basis in the other two that you mentioned is probably not going to get very far. It's asking quite a lot in terms of skill, etc. So it forms a basis, that commitment to ethics. But I would say there's the possibility of imaginal practice and this kind of thinking actually extending our ethical sensibilities and commitments, and bringing in some more challenging questions. So this I addressed, if people are interested, actually quite a few years ago, I wonder if it's 2011 or 2012, with two talks, one called The Meditator is Revolutionary and one called The Necessity of Fantasy. And they were both kind of critiques, if you like, of the typical Dharmic Buddhist ways of thinking about ethics and where, in fact, they limit our behavior. So, and the example I was drawing on there was concern for the environment and also about climate change. So you would expect, if it was so simple that everyone just needs to be mindful, everyone needs to learn to be calm and train their mind in this way or see that there is no self, you would expect that Buddhists and certainly teachers of Buddhism would, for instance, make radical commitments in relationship to climate change. That's just an obvious ethical choice. The fact is, at that time, that wasn't the case. And the question is why? And why is it that there's so little sort of, I don't know what to call it, strong and gutsy outspokenness and activism around ethical issues and issues of social, environmental, and political concern among Buddhists and Buddhist teachers? And one way of approaching that critique is actually saying, well, the images and archetypes that kind of limit, infuse and limit how we think of the Dharma are actually constraining the ethical range. So that the image we have of the Buddha sitting silently, calmly, unmoved, kind, but not really involved, silently in meditation with his eyes closed, actually starts to infiltrate the life and the ethical choices. So it's almost bringing in, saying there's a whole other realm here of our psychology, the image and the archetype, etc., that is influencing things, but we're not talking about it. We're just talking in simplistic terms, mindfulness, reduction of suffering, seeing the illusion of self, etc. And just look, is it actually addressing the issues? How is it limiting the ethics? So with Sila, with ethics, it forms a basis, absolutely, a solid basis, and possibly imaginal practice, soul making practice can extend that. With second one, the actual word in Pali is samadhi, usually gets translated as concentration. I don't particularly like that word because I don't think it really brings out what the Buddha was talking about. It is not just the ability to nail your mind to some object and keep it there, come what may, without wavering at all. That's a fairly useful skill, but it's pretty limited. The Buddha talked much more about jhanas, deep absorptions, which are a lot more to do with well-being and mystical experience and opening up of sensibility and sensitivity. All that meditative skill, again, forms a basis or at least an important component, a developing component of soul-making practice. As I said before, it takes a lot of delicacy, sensitivity, nuance of the art of meditation, meditative skill with all kinds of dimensions of our being to be able to do this work. It's like doing some kind of really delicate sculpture or dance or something like that. It needs a lot of skill. So yes, focus and calm and jhanas and all of that, but also a lot of other meditative skills I alluded to. The third one, insight, mindfulness, we could talk about any, you know, mindfulness, insight, emptiness. These are all important components. You know, one of the things, for example, that we do in soul making practice is really kind of bring back in the whole experience and energy of desire and the whole question of desire. Is it something that I just need to let go of? get rid of, get over? And actually, are there ways that I can open up my experience of desire so it opens me up and opens up other directions? So, but to do all that, I need to be able to let go. I need a simple mindfulness. I need to be able to put things down and let go and all that kind of stuff. With emptiness, which is also a component of this third punya, which in the Pali is wisdom or insight. Again, we talked about this in our first episode, or this actually technically our second, but the last one. Most teachings of emptiness just kind of say something like the self is an illusion, or dissolve the self or explode it or something and stop there and maybe get to some kind of absolute or unfabricated. I think soul-making teachings and national practice are based on an understanding of emptiness that goes beyond just the deconstruction, that because it sees that everything is empty, including deconstruction, it legitimizes a playing with reconstruction. So it's based on a different understanding of emptiness. It's not that everyone needs to have a very deep experience of emptiness to be able to do soul-making practice, but some people do. Some people need that. Some people take it on faith, and some people legitimize it in other ways. Also, it's very common for people doing imaginal practice to actually find that their understanding and experience of emptiness, not just of self, but also of world, the emptiness of world as well as self, actually opens up, deepens, grows from doing imaginal practice without doing much more emptiness practice. So that's a way it can work that way around as well.
Okay. And I'd like to kind of double click on the emptiness piece, because another sort of inquiry that I heard people represent was something like, you know, I still don't really understand what the point of imaginal work is. You know, you talk about seeing emptiness and how that frees the mind. That seems like an endpoint to me. And then they go on to say something like, you know, no self, no intrinsic reality, no problem. What's all this imaginal stuff for?
Right. Yeah. So this would be a very understandable and probably common sort of question that someone would have. I have to say, you know, I'm really not wanting to evangelize or convince anyone. I mean, maybe other people are, but it's not something I want to do about all this stuff. I don't even claim that it's better or whatever than anything else. Some people will, like myself, will go very deep into emptiness, all of it, absolutely all of it. Deeper than also maybe some other conceptions of emptiness, I still want more. And what is this more? Where does that come from? It's partly what we call the eros. So there's something in some people, in some personalities, if you like, in a certain language, in some souls that wants more. And what more does it want? It wants the soul making. It wants those kinds of perceptions. So others won't have that. And they're just purely engaged in a kind of technology for the reduction of suffering. And they're just maximizing the reduction of suffering. Thank you very much. That's all I came for. That satisfies me. That's fine. Why should I or anyone else try to convince those people that they need anything more? But others will, who have certain personalities, who love deeply, who have a lot of eros, who have a lot of what we call soul, for whom the imagination speaks to them anyway, they will want a different paradigm. We could also ask, for example, what does seeing that there's no intrinsic reality, seeing that there's no self, what does that imply, for instance, about such areas of my being or domains of my being as my sexuality? What does it imply or what does it give, what does it affect in terms of my relationship with nature, other than it's all one, it's all flow, it's all one? What does it imply about the whole way that I see the self and personality? And it's probably the case that in most of what most people think of as this kind of seeing of not self or even understanding of emptiness, that kind of liberation, none of those areas are really opened up to be very fertile. They can be an absence of problem there and a certain freedom of movement, but they're not really a generative, fertile, rich, important, meaningful, sacred. Lastly, and connected with that, is that when we travel the emptiness path and the samadhi path in terms of jhanas, and I think we touched on this in the last episode, there's probably, I don't know, I've never counted them, but there's certain very predictable experiences that happen, sometimes not in order, but most often in a kind of progression. And you can kind of gather them up and just, you know what's going to happen. And there is not just a decrease in suffering, there's also a sacredness there, which to some people is very important. But the kinds of perception of sacredness are, if you like, limited in scope. There's like X flavors. I've never counted X, but I don't know, 25 or something. These are the experiences. And again, it's like, is there something in us, or let's say in some people, that wants more, that is not satisfied by that? We can call that craving or greed, or we can call it eros and a desire of the soul for soul making. So that would be some of the things I would say in response to that.
Great. And you touched on this a little bit, but this is another kind of question that I think was well represented in the conversation. And it's around kind of prerequisites. And specifically, is this kind of work something that really is only makes sense to do after achieving kind of a certain level of what we might like insight into emptiness?
Yeah. I want to be cautious here. And so I will say, for me personally, and I think I described that in one of our conversations, for me, going really deep into emptiness and deeper than I had come across anywhere before, in fact, it was what kind of landed me or opened me, left me in a place that legitimized all this, what was to come in terms of the exploration. I don't know whether everyone needs to do that. Certainly some people, and I know I can think of some students, they had to do all that. They even got to the point they can see there's no self, they can have an experience that unfabricated, and some people, what people would call stream entry in even further, but they needed to go further with the emptiness to actually legitimize this non-duality between the fabricated and the unfabricated, this opening up of the possibility of seeing sacredness everywhere. So for some people, that's what needs to happen. And other people don't. They already have, maybe from modern philosophical inquiry or just having kind of living with a kind of wide and deep artistic sensibility, they already have what they need in terms of the legitimization of it for themselves. So they're free to play. Now, the skills that are needed, these I think are quite, there's quite a lot asked. You know, a lot of soul making happens in relationship. We're beginning to open up that, how people practice with each other with all this stuff. It takes a lot in terms of honesty, in terms of psychological awareness, in terms of emotional sensitivity, capacity of the heart, of the intellect to play lightly with ideas and entertain possibilities, all kinds of sensitivities to what was called in the energy body, somatic experience. I think that's all part of it. Whether someone kind of has so much kind of pull towards this kind of practice, it's so meaningful for them, or they recognize and they have to learn that on the fly as they go, that may be the case. So I think it asks a lot exactly what order things happen in for different people. I think that's more open and fluid.
Yeah, and just to add a little bit from my perspective on this question, I think one of the things that you helped me differentiate between was what we might call like the experience of cessation and the understanding that that's the whole point of why we meditate, which is to understand or see the way that emptiness is so clearly that our suffering is alleviated. At least that was how I made sense of it. And so, you know, I think I also have friends, people that I've met who have needed very little meditation to, I think, understand emptiness and have insights in that direction, because they've had a lot of philosophical and intellectual training around things like postmodern philosophy or, you know, neuroscience, which shows that the self is a kind of like epiphenomenon of collections of networks in the brain firing and so on and so forth. So, you know, just to kind of further destabilize this fixation on cessation, which I remember when I was a member of this kind of pragmatic Dharma community, in my mind was, you know, people were really gunning for it, and as was I for many years of my life. And so just wanted to add my kind of two cents to that. And then another question that came up is this just a kind of new version of magic or tantra? You know, it seems like this is the imaginal is a way to allow or include magical practices in a constructive manner, kind of meddling in the apparent contradiction between insight and magic practices. Is that a fair assessment of what the imaginal is?
I'm not entirely sure what people mean when they say magic. If it's the kind of attempt to sort of influence the course of events or influence matter in some way, then no, there's quite a difference. But because the intention in the soul making practices is not for the sake of more and more, it's not for the sake of anything but soul making, anything but that opening up of the sacredness and the richness, etc. So that's one of the distinctions we talk about in one of the elements of the imaginal being a fullness of intention, meaning there's a kind of humility and the intention is for soul making. But I don't really know what you mean when you say magic. So perhaps you could explain that, Daniel.
The Redditor in question, I don't think really explained what they meant, so I'm not sure. I think maybe we could have a similar question though around Tantra. Like, is this a new version of Tantra?
Right. So there's different kinds of Buddhist Tantra, and there's other kinds of non-Buddhist Tantras, but it has some similarities, but we could point to a few differences. For instance, usually in a Vajrayana or tantric practice, the images that you are given are prescribed. They belong to a kind of limited range of tantric deities, etc., or bodhisattvas, or this and that. And oftentimes it's actually your guru, your teacher, who will say, you meditate on this. That's your image. And then it's a very prescribed form and a very prescribed way of meditate. Do this, you do this, you imagine it looks like this, etc. And you go through a certain sadhana or ritual, etc. with that. But I think with imaginal practices, one of the differences there is that we don't prescribe images. So we're more talking about a kind of meta framework of practicing with any image that comes up, or any sense of a deity, or any object that comes up. And we trust more in what comes to the practitioner as an image or as a perception. Occasionally we'll be in a group and, for instance, share an image together or whatever, or people will do that in dialogue. But basically it's open. It's not prescribed like that. A more, I think, related but more fundamental difference between, say, soul-making practice or imaginal practice and Tantra is that Tantra is still premised, however distant it might seem and however rarely they might talk about it, is still premised on the Four Noble Truths. the idea of suffering and enlightenment is the eradication of suffering. There's, again, however different it is from the original Pali canon teachings, there's an image of what awakening is, what Buddhahood is, and this is where we're going. So the whole thing is in a kind of, however extravagant and far out and distant it might feel in the future with Tantra in terms of eons and all that, is still within a actually prescribed and fixed idea of what awakening is, a fixed logos or conceptual concept of what awakening is. And one of the kind of maybe challenging but kind of radical things about soul making dharma is it even begins to subsume that whole question of awakening. So we begin to recognize our fantasies in the good sense, our images regarding the path, regarding awakening, and the whole sense of possibility of what can open up and what awakening can be just begins. We get a sense that it can just extend indefinitely in a very beautiful way, a very, very fecund way. And our sense of who we are on the path of where we're going and why we're doing this. So in some sense, it kind of breaks the box even of the walls or even of that very far out idea of awakening that you get in Vajrayana. So that would be a more fundamental and far reaching difference.
Mm. Wonderful. And okay. So then this next question, I guess I'm not sure if it was in response to our conversation or the article I wrote that went along with our conversation. And so first I want to just check with you, Rob, would you agree that one of the effects of this kind of work can be that it sort of amplifies your sense of meaningfulness in your life?
Yeah. Yes, okay. Definitely. Yeah.
Okay. And then the question then is, to me, meaning comes primarily from doing things that are meaningful. For example, deepening relationships with people I love and doing things that help reduce suffering or solve some important problem. I can't understand how the imaginal would improve my relationships or help reduce carbon emissions or help people suffer less. Meditation, on the other hand, directly creates more meaning for me because it reduces my own suffering and cultivates virtues like compassion, which in turn improves my relationships and helps me focus on what's important to me. How does the imaginal actually improve my sense of meaningfulness?
Okay, yeah. It's a big question. And again, I very much would expect that kind of question or difficulty in understanding something. But just because of what we've all been saturated in, both by the modernist worldview that we can't help walking around in our world, but also by the Dharma view, which again emphasizes, well, the whole point is reducing suffering and removing the obstacles to a reduction of suffering and also to things like compassion and universal kindness and that sort of thing. But it might be, for instance, if you talk about relationships, that there's a possibility of meeting another person, of interacting with another person that just opens up and perceives and is touched by other dimensions of the being that we had no sense of before. And this gives, as I say, different kinds of sacredness, different kinds of beauty, different kinds of duty as well, different echoes of the meaningfulness and all that in our life. This person is no longer just a flat human being or just a product of evolution or just a set of neurons that begin to feel the world in a certain way or sense the world in a certain way. This person is also angel, has other dimensions to them. Again, I'm not claiming that as a reality or insisting that's real and the other is not real. But we open up the legitimacy and the actuality of those kind of senses of things, and a sense of myself, a sense of my place, and also a sense of the world. So again, it's like, why should we bother about the climate? There's one level is just because as climate change kicks in more, there is more suffering. The net suffering goes up in the world. And therefore, just functionally, we want to reduce that suffering. But there's a whole other dimension possible and attractive to some people, that there's a kind of unspeakable range of possibility of this, our sense of the beauty and the sacrednesses and the divinity and dimensionality and mystery and unfathomability and purposefulness of nature, either single things in nature or the totality of it. And that gives other levels to our sense of being, our sense of what the world is. A lot of what might happen in sort of certain psychological ways of approaching things that are quite common, or certain Dharma ways of approaching things, is it all takes place against a backdrop that's just of the world, that's just assumed to be a certain way. All the my intention for my healing, my psychological healing, my Dharma healing, my intention for a good relationship, etc., or to reduce suffering, or this or that, it all takes place against what's essentially a meaningless backdrop of flatly conceived matter. It's kind of often operating with that implicit assumption in the background. If we, for example, as one of the things that's possible, we can begin to question and open up that whole assumption, and all kinds of other perceptions and feelings and dedication is possible in relation to all that stuff. So I don't know, just that gives the beginnings of an answer.
Yeah, it does. And I want to spend maybe a little bit more time here, because I think it's such a useful distinction for people who are coming to this from a, you know, Buddhist background. And that is, we might say that the purpose of a traditional Buddhist path is the dampening and perhaps eradication of suffering, of dukkha. And then I think it's fair to say, Rob, that perhaps the purpose of the imaginal path, in a sense, is the amplification of what you've called soul making. And if that's the case, you know, what, and I think what you've said in the last answer is that this, unlike perhaps suffering, is an infinite journey, right? Like there's no end to the process of soul making in your understanding. And I wonder if you could kind of just elaborate a little bit more on that distinction between suffering and soul making, and say a little bit more about like what exactly it is that soul making is.
These are really big questions. So let's see, and maybe you can pitch in if you have any thoughts. So, so soul making is a vague term, and it's deliberately vague. It's a deliberately elastic term, but what we could talk about something called soulfulness, or certain language. Soul making is the engagement with experience, participation in experience, let's say, whether it's intrapsychic or extrapsychic, that brings with it a sense of soulfulness. And what does soulfulness mean? It means, and here we could rattle off a long list, depth, a sense of depth, beauties, mysteries, eros, is characterized by humility, by this being touched in the heart, by the kinds of sense of sacredness multiplying, complexifying, getting wider and wider, not being restricted. There's a sense perhaps of vulnerability, even of divinity, even if I don't have a kind of rigid or fixed or even clear theology worked out, there is a sense of divinity that opens up. reverence, dimensionality, love, all these are aspects, and we could list many more, that are characteristic, makeup, constitute what we call a sense of soulfulness. So making is whatever practices and attitudes and thoughts and ways of being open up and support that sense, a sense of soulfulness and a widening sense of soulfulness. So we have a sense, this is something I'm doing, I'm creating this, but I'm also somehow discovering this. In the process of doing that, when I start to engage those practices and attitudes and ideas, etc., that create and discover a sense of soulfulness, then, if you like, my ability, my capacity, and my dexterity to experience in those kinds of ways again and further, to extend that experience, increases just by virtue of practice, by virtue of that opening, building on those openings. So we could say, if we define soul as a thoroughly empty phenomenon, but if we define it as it's that in the being, that organ, if you like, or instrument of the being that can sense inner and outer, can sense, can perceive in ways that bring soulfulness. Soul making then is the generating of soulfulness and the supporting of my capacity, my organ, my instrument to sense that way. Mm. So I don't know if that answers.
We'll find out when we share this conversation, I suppose, if it feels satisfied to the person who posted that question. And then before, so the last question from Reddit that I want to share in this space, and I think it's my favorite question is this a cult?
Is this what, a cult?
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you feel like you're in a cult, Daniel?
I mean, well, I've never met you in person. I don't know. I mean, I when I saw this question, I said, well, if it is, I hope I get my cult, you know, decoder ring in the mail soon, because I haven't really been getting much correspondence from the other cult members, I gotta say.
You can be in a cult of one, I suppose, but yeah. I mean, is it a cult? So I don't know what's a cult. I mean, generally it seems to me that a cult is something that is doesn't allow differences of opinion, that is quite rigid in its hierarchy, and when there are differences of opinion or expressions of individuality, they are met with in some kind of shaming way or punitive way, etc. There's a kind of dogma there that's sort of enforced. There's a disempowering of individuals and their autonomy, etc. These kinds of things it's seem to me characteristic of a cult. Would you add anything more, Daniel?
I mean, yeah, I think that's a pretty fair assessment. Yeah.
Okay. So, I would say that, I can't remember what I said now, but let's see. I think I personally, and I it kind of explicit in the teachings, is that this is a creative and elastic and open-ended paradigm. In other words, whatever ideas we have that one might call dogma are more intended to A, open things up. They're a process of opening things up. And also explicit in the teachings is that the whole conceptual framework will be stretched and will also shatter, will break at some point, will include contradictions, etc. And my hope very strongly is that as things go on, if they do go on or whatever, that people will start to feel like they can be creative and bring their discoveries and their creations into the whole paradigm. So it begins to be organic. No one owns it. But it's a bit like science. You know, is science a cult? No, not really. It's just that you do need quite a lot, going back to what you asked earlier, you do need quite a lot of understanding and skill to kind of really offer something valuable into the scientific discourse or the philosophical discourse or whatever it is. So it asks that. What were the other things? Can you remind me?
Attributes of a cult.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I think we've responded to this question adequately. I think it was, you know, I partly brought it up as a joke because it's so not what this is, but I also want to recognize the place that this kind of question is coming from in terms of, you know, in the spiritual world, there's a lot of sketchy stuff going down. And, you know, it is easy to see radical claims or new quote unquote paradigms and be suspicious that they're coming from a place where people want to make money or control other people. And I think, you know, that's not what's happening here from my perspective, you know, being an ocean away from you, Rob, and your and the community in the UK. But I do think that, you know, we've done a good job of, you know, dissuading people from that perspective. But if, you know, we share this conversation, they still have questions, you know, that can be maybe that can we can reflect on that more and see what they really mean by the term cult. But in any case, I appreciate you playing ball with that question, because I think it's helpful. And then so the last question that I think we can spend however much time you want to give to it, because we've now kind of exhausted the questions that I took out of the conversation on Reddit. And now we can kind of take a step back, I think, as we discussed previously, and sort of reflect on why these kinds of questions and this desire for, maybe we could say, like simplicity in explanation is so challenging within the context of the imaginal. And the story that I'm remembering as I asked this question, I think you shared it was either Feynman or some other Nobel Prize winning scientist who, when a reporter asked him, like, why can't you just sum up your discovery in one or two sentences? And the scientist responded, well, if I could sum it up in one or two sentences, do you think they'd be giving me a Nobel Prize? Right. And so there's this kind of tension, I think, between our desire for simplicity and, you know, what it is that you're pointing to, and what it is, I think, that acts of discovery in general can point to, at least if in my estimation, paradigm shifting. You know, you don't have to agree with that assessment, but I'm curious to hear you respond, like, to that sort of tension between perhaps simplicity and clarity and all that.
You know, there's certain things that it's totally appropriate to explain simply. If we were, you know, if I was an engineer and I was trying to explain to you the engineering challenges and mechanisms of a suspension bridge, just lay it out simply or whatever, or even, you know, the kind of process of nuclear fission in an atom bomb or something like that. That's completely appropriate. I think there are other things that are not so easy to explain. Even explaining emptiness can be, to a certain extent, relatively simple. And explaining what I would call meditative techniques and technologies can be and should be relatively clear. And it's something when I do that as a teacher, I really try to take as much care to make it really clear what people can do. And then there are other kind of, you know, domains of human being and human exploration and that just won't be reduced that way. You know, it's not appropriate. We actually kill something. And more than that, there's something, if we go back to this word soul, soul doesn't only want what's simple. So the movement of a lot of let's say mindfulness meditation, and then a lot of typical Dharma is towards more and more simplicity. just this moment, just this breath, just this sight, just this sound, etc., etc. And then even beyond that to just this, it's all one. All diversity, all complexity dissolves into some kind of oneness, etc. So the movement is towards simplicity. That is part of, we could say, the soul is fulfilled, the being is fulfilled to a certain extent in that movement towards those kinds of deep simplicities. But there's another part of what I've called the soul just now that actually wants richness and complexity and will generate it and will discover it and will create it, more facets to things, complex ideas, sophisticated, subtle ideas that expand, that are not so rigid, that fracture into other ideas. That whole richness and fertility and that whole movement of expansion is actually implicit in our whole conceptual framework, and I would say it's what the soul wants. So that's one thing, or a couple of things. I would also say, you know, again, if we explain why, let's say, from the neuroscience point of view, we explain that what's happening neurologically in meditation and how this basically creates happiness or allows happiness. Or even if we don't even go into the neurology and we explain just how training your mind to be calm, to be training in non-distractedness, training into letting go of reactivity, how that supports happiness and well-being and actually also things like efficiency in life. All that is actually really easy to understand and relatively simple to explain. But partly because in explaining in those terms and with those constructs there, we don't have to explain anything new regarding the basic sort of worldview. Everyone knows about neurons to a certain degree. Everyone knows the basic kind of scientific materialism that goes with that, etc., the basic notion of a person and what the purpose of life is and all of that. With this, part of what's happening with this soul-making teachings is that, for instance, we're not going just for a oneness. We're not just going in the direction of dissolving self. We include that, but more than that, there is, as I said in the other podcast and today, there's actually a different understanding of emptiness too. So all that needs explaining. The way that emptiness opens out the legitimacy and the possibility of seeing all kinds of ways of looking and all kinds of sacredness. We're not taking neuroscience as a kind of dogmatic basis or assumption for what a human being is and what the world is made of and how human beings work. We're actually at times questioning that or opening up very different worldviews, very different anthropological views. In fact, where we don't even have one worldview. So it's not like, oh, here's the worldview. What this legitimizes, not just ways of looking, a diversity of ways of looking, but a diversity of conceptual frameworks. So I can go into a neurological point of view and just look at things that way and understand, of course, fine. I just don't believe it's ultimately real. I can come out of that and go into all kinds of other ways, or a practitioner can. So there are multiple, actually infinite, endless possibilities for worldview. That's another thing. Another reason is we have to actually, if we're going to get into this, actually have to start re-legitimizing or convincing people, perhaps, if they demand convincing, re-legitimizing the imagination. Which has been denigrated for the most part over several hundred years in Western society. I also have to re-legitimize or give place to and reason for, let's take another look at desire. Are we just trying to let go of it? Are there other things we can do with desire? There are other levels and elements of desire that can open us up. So all this is very, very different from both the typical Western modernist worldview and also the typical sort of set of Dharma assumptions. So all that is going to need investigating, unpacking, etc., convincing, all that. You know, so that's partly why it's difficult to explain, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what is coming to my mind, there's this book that I'm reading now by, I think he's a physicist, David Deutsch, called The Beginning of Infinity, Explanations That Transform the World. And he makes the argument in this book that, you know, he says that all progress, both theoretical and practical, has resulted from a single human activity, the quest for what I call good explanations. And good explanations can be quite complex because reality itself is quite complex. And so especially if we're attempting to move forward a paradigm, it will probably look quite complicated as it's being built, just as I imagine, you know, modernism probably looked quite complicated to pre-modern people. You know, we had to have a whole like enlightenment for it to come into being. And so just so, you know, these things, I think that Rob, you're talking about, like, there is the possibility of a simplicity on the other side of complexity, but the explanations themselves, at least I've experienced them to be themselves kind of psychoactive and sort of threaten various materials that I've built my conceptualization of the world out of. And so there is a function of explanation that goes beyond this sort of just practice and pragmatic, or maybe not, but certainly this practice-based sort of sense of what it is that, for instance, meditation is all about. Like, and you can actually experience this in a Dharma talk. If you listen to a good Dharma talk, it itself does things to you. It itself makes you experience the world differently. And so I just wanted to kind of add that piece because I think that aspect is so often underestimated by Buddhist practitioners and spiritual practitioners in general, because I think there is this kind of retreat from the complexity of life and a desire for the simplicity of Buddhist practice that I see in a lot of these spaces. And I wonder if there's anything you'd like to say about that in terms of the kind of cultural context, which might make people so hungry for a simple explanation.
Thank you for that. That was very, very beautifully put, and you covered a lot. I'm not sure what to add or if you're after something in particular. I'd just like to say that I'm not against the movement of simplifying and simplification of consciousness, of perception, of thought, etc. I think what I kind of object to a little bit is when that overextends itself and we only hold in esteem that movement towards simplification, either meditatively or conceptually or in the way we look at the world. So it's a certain gear one can go, or it's a set of gears, those movements towards simplification. It's great. And again, you ask, what are the skills? What are the prerequisites? Yeah, the ability to do that meditatively and with the thinking and let's just simplify and look at it this way. That's really important. You know, there's a lot of relief that comes, especially as you point out, in our society these days. It's so complex in so many ways, and our minds that are full of thoughts and all that. I think what I would just like to add and say again is there are other desires in the being for many, many people, not for everyone. And if going towards the simple and simplifying everything and just the reduction of suffering does it for someone, that's great. Go for it. You know, I'm not insisting or trying to convert anyone at all, but my experience is so much working with people that some in their experience with let's say a difficulty, when it's looked up and opened up in a soul making way with all the complexity that brings, that they are kind of, it's fulfilled something or satisfied or quenched temporarily something in them that isn't in the simplification. Mm-hmm. As you said, just a couple more things. So imagine us being kind of time transported back to medieval times, and we're going to try and convince someone about the neuroscience of meditation. they would be completely bamboozled. Like, they just wouldn't understand what we were talking about, even just assuming that there was no God or whatever it is. So yeah, this is all contextual. What we hold as complex, and there's a certain, as actually Owen Barfield, I think I might have mentioned this in a talk, said, a knot, like a knot in a shoelace, is actually quite a complex thing. When you untie the knot, you're left with a simpler state, two bits of string that are not knotted. The movements you have to make to untie that knot are the hand movements, the finger movements, actually usually pretty complicated, but you're ending up with something that's simpler. So this whole question of complexity and simplicity is not, well, guess what? It's not as simple as it seems. And the other thing, just to touch on what you said, and I said this, I think, in one of our podcasts, there's also the re-ensouling of the intellect, of concept, of ideas, of thought, and the possibility of that becoming beautiful and rich and, again, endlessly kind of fecund and far-reaching in its implications. And yes, there is something both, I think, necessary to crack open, for some people, it's a kind of rigidification or solidification of certain ideational structures won't allow this kind of soul-making experience. They will just refuse it. It will just be dismissed within a certain rigid belief structure or set of assumptions. So sometimes that needs cracking open. That knot, go back to that analogy, needs untying. And that takes quite a lot of work. However, I view both the ideas themselves and the challenging of ideas and the cracking open of conceptual frame, I view all that as part of soul making. As you said, sometimes that can be as exciting for the soul as working with an image directly. So idea and image, to go back to what we said at the beginning, are part of soul making. So I don't know if I answered what you actually asked, but
I don't know, but I enjoyed it nonetheless. Okay. And I'm also wanted to say, like, I'm going to go out on a limb and imagine that, or say that, if you made it to the end of this conversation and it was interesting to you, that you are the kind of person who has these other dimensions and wants to explore them, right? Like, the expression of curiosity itself is implicated in this whole kind of perspective and paradigm. And so just to include that, and just name that if you're listening now, you kind of made it to the end of this conversation, and hopefully it was interesting to you. And in that case, there's something there. If there's anything that you want to say to kind of move this conversation towards a closing.
Let's see, just a couple of things. I mean, one is in relation to what you just said, that so far, in my experience, most people have gotten into this kind of practice or these kinds of ideas or this body of teachings, etc., these practices. Most people have gotten into it in a way that it became, like, profoundly and widely important in their lives and their practices, either from just hearing a couple of kind of randomly selected Dharma talks on the subject, of which there are many now, and even though they didn't understand it all and didn't have, from that one Dharma talk, didn't get a grasp of the whole framework, but something was touched, or in the examples given, or something that was said in the ideas questioned, something was recognized, something drew them on, and they wanted to explore more. So there's that kind of probably the majority of people who are interested. Or or Catherine is at the moment, there's not more teachers than that. Hopefully there will be. But Catherine are working with someone one-on-one or in a small group with some difficulty that they have, some suffering, some pain. And if it's me and I'm the teacher, I kind of intuit that, if you like, an image is in the air. There's the possibility of this, of them accessing an image or an imaginal perspective or sensing the soul of themselves or the situation or the problem, and then guiding them gently through that, helping that to open up for them. And then they experience something that's more than just the there is almost always a decrease in the suffering, a relief of the suffering and easing. But they experience more than that. They experience this sense of soulfulness and beauty and meaningfulness and mystery and duty and grace and all the rest of it. And they're profoundly touched by that. That touches them as it speaks to them more than just, ah, good, I got rid of the suffering. Ah, good, I feel some relief, some ease. It doesn't just... this kind of practice doesn't just dissolve the suffering, but it kind of opens up different perspectives on it, different kind of dimensions or levels of it. And then from that experience, they want to explore more. Mm. It will be interesting what happens from this podcast. I don't know. It might be that you and I sort of sitting here and discussing kind of slightly abstract and brief sort of attempt to explanation is that the explanation of the sort of paradigms involved that does give rise to a real kind of passion and interest for some people, but that probably will be fairly new, although you described your experience there. Mm. But again, it's like it seems like one thread I would give a personal actually just reiteration of what I just said and something that's been a thread through our conversation. You know, so I have this illness for the last 3 years, pancreatic cancer with very very poor prognosis, and all kinds of challenges with that, from a very extreme radical operation and extensive chemotherapy, all kinds of drugs and side effects and things going wrong with my system. So if I just speak personally now, you know, I am 52 years old, facing a possible early death, all kinds of physical pain, discomfort, a lot of incapacity. There's a lot that I can no longer do because of my illness and because of the drugs and all that, limitations, etc. Now, I can, because of the training in what you're calling pragmatic dharma and my explorations of that and my dedication to that over years, I could just be with all this or with different elements of the difficulty of what's involved in a kind of really extreme illness like I have. I could just approach that with a set of tools of what we might call pragmatic dharma, with whatever extensions I have in my view of emptiness, and just decrease the suffering. I could see the emptiness of myself. I could see the emptiness of the illness. I can see the emptiness of dying. I can see the emptiness of time, etc., etc. And I do draw on that quite regularly. And it just punctures the suffering there and brings a perspective of something deathless or et cetera. So that's very available and that's very important and good. But here am I in this situation dealing with this, and something in me wants more than that. Wants more than that in relation to this illness, in relation to the possibility of dying at still fairly a young man, et cetera. I want something in me wants something more than just the quelling of suffering, the release of dis-ease. Something in me wants soul making. Something in me wants to ensoul this illness, this death, and this life. And it's not because I'm afraid of the fact of dying, or I'm afraid of meaningless or anything like that. So when I practice with it, with the difficulties that come up and the wide range of difficulties there, I find myself just drawn to, out of curiosity, what's possible here in relating to this, in the perception of my body, my illness, my death, and all that. And the intention is for soul making. There's eros there in my very approach to this very obvious disease and everything that it brings. I want more than just the reduction of suffering. Mm. So there's a personal example. And, you know, some people will be like, I don't get it. It's not important. That's, as I said, I've said three or four times, that's completely fine, you know. But there will be other people who, when they taste that something more, whether it's before they've done all the emptiness thing or after they've done the emptiness thing or to some degree gone down that path of emptiness, they will say, I want this too. I want this too. I want that opening. It adds colors, dimensions, directions, beauties, sacrednesses that are otherwise not available. And we can just say something in the soul wants that for some portion of the human population, something like that.
Thank you, Rob.
Sure.
Okay, well, that brings our conversation, I think, more or less to a closing point for now. I'm sure that there will be more questions, but you know, thank you so much, Rob, for coming on the show and being willing to engage with this feedback. I think that you know, our capacity to respond to feedback, like what you're demonstrating right now, I think for me at least, is an indication of a worthwhile system, is a worth, like that it is willing to engage with the world in this way. And Reddit, you don't know, Rob, because you don't use Reddit. I've been a Reddit user for, gosh, like 8 or 9 years. I know my user account is 6 years old. And so I know the kind of place that can be. And I think it's really heartening to me as a Reddit user and just as a citizen of the internet that you are willing to engage in this kind of participatory dialogue. So I just want to thank you and appreciate you and appreciate this conversation for taking place. So thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Daniel. It's my pleasure. It's enjoying being with you and having this conversation. I as you said, I don't know that audience, but I hope that it's helpful and interesting for those who might be drawn, you know, who might be wanting to explore something like this. So thank you.